Good evening and welcome to Thinking Out Loud from KBIA. I'm Darren Helwedge. You know, we have some very exciting programs planned for the weeks and months ahead. Some really good stuff. Tonight, though, we're going to have a best of show. I decided to do something special with this one. Typically, when we do a best of show, we've got one of a couple of dozen shows that really are kind of our best of, our golden oldies, and we've re-aired some of those on a number of times, or we'll re-air a fairly recent show. Tonight, instead, we're going to do something different. We're going to go back more than 9 years for one of the first shows we ever did. It is in our archives listed as Thinking 13. So it's just a few months into the run of the show. You probably heard earlier this summer of changes coming to a Columbia institution. My old friend Richard King sold the Blue Note Club. Well, while looking through the archives today, I discovered an interview that I did with Richard. It was in noting of the 25th anniversary of the club back in 2005. And to my recollection, it's never aired since that time. But it is really a fun look back at the history, at least to that point, of the Blue Note, one of the more interesting success stories in Columbia's business community. It's a blast from the past, our 2005 interview with Richard King tonight, a best of Thinking Out Loud on KBIA. This week we're talking with Richard King. Richard has been the owner from day one of the Blue Note. Blue Note, of course, the live music club here in Columbia, mostly bringing what's called alternative rock and roll in the early days, punk rock, new wave, a lot of other things too, but that's been their main focus, and they've been a huge part of the Columbia music scene for all those years. We get the story not only of how the Blue Note started and how it has survived and thrived for 25 years, but we'll talk about some of the stories, musicians that have come through the place, and obviously they're going to have some fun stories about that, but some of the people who have worked at the Blue Note have left impressions on Richard as well. Richard King talking about the Blue Note on their 25th anniversary here on KBIA. Richard King with us. He is the owner and manager of the Blue Note Club, a live music club here in Columbia, and they are celebrating their 25th anniversary. We're going to visit a little bit about the history of the Blue Note and some of the things that they have planned to celebrate that anniversary. Richard, welcome.
Oh, great to be here, Darren.
Let's start with getting you into town, first of all, because you're not a local from Pennsylvania, and it seems like you and Walsh wandered in about the same time, didn't you, Kevin Walsh?
Yeah, Kevin was off to graduate school at the University of Missouri here. Kevin and I were good friends back in Pennsylvania. We hung out a lot together. We went to concerts, lots of concerts together. He moved out here, and I had about enough of living back home, and it was time to move on myself. So my trip was intended to go all the way to California. But I stopped right here in Columbia, Mo.
Got about halfway there and found a place to settle in a little bit. How soon after you got to town were you starting to work in other clubs?
Well, when I first got here, I was, you know, I picked up some restaurant work actually right across the street here at the Heidelberg, working for Dick Walls.
Oh yeah.
And he remodeled back in 76 or 77, and when I came, you know, he closed down for several months. I went home and went to visit some friends in Chicago, came back, and I was a manager there. Stuck around there for a few years. And then my good friend Phil Costello, who I started the Blue Note with,
right.
He and I were roommates also. It was myself, Kevin, and Phil. Phil was actually working at the Brief Encounter, which was about to go out of business. The owner was having some difficulties with divorce or whatever. So Phil and I talked about it, and we found ourselves the buyers of that club.
Now we're talking, of course, about the what would be referred to as the old Blue Note or the location over on Business Loop. It was a biker bar, wasn't it, or something like that?
We got into a lot of trouble with the bikers.
Oh no!
Well, you know, and to tell you the truth, there was a lot of great folks involved there, but it was more about, you know, the image that we were trying to portray, and yeah. We wanted to be more of a college bar. We were definitely interested. We wanted to open up the world of music in our eyes anyway, the things that we listen to. We wanted to try and present those things in Columbia. And at that time, a lot of the things you were hearing, there were good bands, but it wasn't kind of the thing that we wanted to do. You know, we were just into all different kinds of music, and we were and in that year, 1980, things like, I think, MTV popped on right around then. And you know, and the alternative music scene all of a sudden wasn't so alternative, you know, because it was getting that exposure.
Sure.
You know, and we just really scoured record stores and stuff we found that we liked. You know, we did our best to bring them to Columbia.
Music was doing some interesting stuff right about that time. The time frame you're talking about, I was in high school, and people at my high school think I'm this real punk because I'm listening to U2. Well, now U2 is adult, contemporary, middle of the road, whatever. But at that point, REM, Alarm, U2, the type
Elvis
stuff.
Elvis Costello would be another one.
Yeah, people thought that was really, that's where the strange kids were listening to.
Well, you know, it was funny because we were located right next to the Pow Wow Lounge back in those days down there. And it was, the accusations was, oh, those kids with the purple and the blue hair and all that kind of stuff. And we'd be like, well, geez, we kind of like this music, you know. So, yeah, it was interesting. The start was very interesting. We were scraping every dollar we could together to get the Blue Note open.
Yeah.
And I'll never forget our visits to certain banks, and they just sort of like laughed at us. They go, we don't lend money to bars or open bars.
Yeah,
you know, I mean,
yeah.
That's, you know, most of the people that we lend money to probably whatever don't, you know, whatever, you know, aren't successful, that
sure.
kind of thing. So we learned, one of the my discoveries was I was never, and boy, you know, I guess I'll have to admit this, I was never a big Grateful Dead fan.
Yeah.
And there was a gentleman from St. Louis that had a Grateful Dead cover band.
Okay? Oh, okay, yes.
Okay? And he would call me all the time, and he would ask, and I would just say, you know, we're doing this alternative thing.
Right.
You know, I don't
right.
think
that
so.
That doesn't,
you know,
really fit in with the
so
format.
This went on for several months, and finally this guy corners me at a club in Columbia. I was out with some friends, and he just says, hey, he goes, do me a favor, will you? He goes, would you give us just one night? I don't care what night it is, if it's a Monday night, we just want to come to Columbia and see how it goes. And I said, okay, you know, you drove all the way up here from St. Louis. Let's give you the night, right? So I give him a Monday night in the dead of winter, right before finals. And I go home. I get them all sound checked, and I go home and take my shower and eat my dinner, and I'm going to return to the club. And I called to make sure if there's anybody there, if I needed to be there right away, and no one answers the phone. Or the phone was busy. So I tried several times, the phone was busy, so I jumped in my car, I drove down there, and there was a line wrapped all the way around the block.
Cool.
I couldn't get in the door. It was packed inside, okay? And I finally got in the back door. And anyway, it was obviously a hugely successful night.
Right.
And not, you know, and it had nothing to do with me other than putting some flyers up. And after the show, I just said to Randy, the band leader, I said, you know what? I said, I am so sorry. You know, you have opened my eyes to certain things that, you know, and that's kind of, it was a great eye opener for me.
Right.
In terms of, you know, my personal tastes have nothing to do with what's going on here if you want to run a successful business. So, you know, you just have to keep your eyes
sure.
open, your ears open, and I learned a great lesson from those guys.
Well, and you got everybody's got to do that from time to time and put aside what you think might not be the best thing just because the audience likes it.
Well, you know, I've always said that. I go, if I left it up to my personal taste, I would have never made it 5 years out of the box, you know.
Talk about flyers. That has been a big part of what you guys are known for and have done is these kiosks downtown and other places in town, stapling up the posters. Not free advertising, but cheap advertising, certainly. And talk about that and how that all got going.
That's great. You know, that's something I learned from Phil. You know, Phil's job was he would get up every morning and he would do that walk through downtown and through, you know, campus and all that stuff, putting up flyers. And and he did a darn good job of it, and I'll never forget. And I think we are solely responsible for the kiosk being put downtown because there was a local attorney. And before the kiosk, we were putting them up on store windows.
Right.
We were putting them up on walls. We were putting them up on telephone poles.
Right.
And one day we saw a local attorney walking down. And he's ripping them all off the post, and he's just, you know, just we just got finished putting them all up, and this is our only form of advertising. We could not afford any kind of commercial radio or barely get into any newspaper ads and stuff like that. So this was our way of getting the word out. And so we approached this attorney, and he just went crazy on us, telling us how we have a lot of nerve thinking we can do this and that, you know. And And we're standing there, and we just said, you know, I think this was in the middle of Bush's, you know, because we followed them in there. And we said, hey, but this is our only way to advertise. This is the only way we can get the word out. And he just looked at us, and he had, like, sort of this sympathetic look, and he goes, okay, I kind of get you guys. Yeah. You know, we're not really intentional. We are, but, this is important to us.
Right.
This is how we get our message out. And he said, I'll tell you what, next thing you know, we're standing there drinking beers with them. And he goes, tell you what, the city council is about to approve this whole new renovation in downtown Columbia. And I'm going to go to the council and I'm going to ask them that they include kiosks on certain corners in downtown Columbia. Mm-hmm. So you guys have a place to put your stuff.
And other places have a place.
Yeah, and other places have a place. But, you know, it was specifically, and we're sitting there and we're going, wow, really? And you know, and then we became very close friends. It was Dave Baer, the attorney.
Okay,
Dave Baer.
Yeah.
And we became great friends with him, and he became a great supporter of our business.
Great.
But and that was kind of how the kiosk came about, according to what I can remember.
That's still a part of what you guys do, though, to this day. I mean, if I don't see you anywhere else, I'll run across you in downtown, walking around, slapping posters up. You've got your backpack with you full of posters and a staple gun, I suppose.
I have my backpack, my staple gun, my posters, and my little roll of tape, too, just in case
there
might be a spot. But, you know, and it's funny about that, because people say, well, why doesn't Richard have somebody do that, you know? And I honestly, I still enjoy doing it, and I know it sounds crazy, but, you know, when I want to start, the way I like starting my day off with a good 1 hour, hour and a half walk, or
today.
I have my bicycle, and believe me, you can sort of get your day in order by just walking and doing that kind of stuff.
The old location out on the business loop, not the best spot in town to be at 1 or 2 o'clock in the morning as the club is closing down. And I understand you had a couple of incidents back behind the place when closing time came.
Yeah, there are numerous incidents that went on down in that section of town. And, you know, one of the toughest decisions I've ever had to make, and honest to God, was that move from that location, because, you know, that's where it all started.
Sure.
That's where, it's just like pushing 10 years of your life kind of aside and say, well, we'll see you later, you know. But that's that part of town, you know, it was so great, you know, all the kind of crazy things that went on. You had, of course, the Pow Wow Lounge, you know, across the street. And just in general, it's just kind of a, you know, the business loop area. And I'll tell you, in the 5 or 6 months before I left there, the one thing that pushed me over the top to move out of the neighborhood was somebody actually tied a chain to the front door of the Blue Note and to the back of their car and tried to rip the door off the front of the building. So that was like, okay,
it's time to maybe
move out. But yeah.
You got stuck up once, didn't you, in the back lot?
Well, I had my car broken into in the back lot.
Oh, okay.
It was a very, very sad experience. I was leaving the next morning to go back to Pennsylvania to visit my mom and dad and family for Christmas. And what I had done was I put all my clothes, packed clothes, I put all of my everything that I needed to do the next morning in the car, including a deposit, which was a big mistake.
Right, the night's receipts from the club.
Right, and I was just in the club for, it couldn't have been 10 minutes.
Uh-huh.
And somebody broke into the only two cars were in the lot. They put a big old brick right through the back windows. And they just went in and they took everything. You know, even my flight, my airplane tickets. It was, you know, that's, it's like, you think that somebody did it. I thought that somebody that knew me had done it, that kind of
right.
thing. So you really don't know what to think. And, you know, such an invasion. But, as it turned out, you know, of course, Columbia police were great on this.
Right.
And by the time I had, you know, gotten back to Pennsylvania, I left. I'm, of course, there was nothing I could do. And I just
right. That's
repacked
money
the
that's
bag.
Gone. It's all probably mostly cash.
Right.
And,
mostly cash.
Yeah.
I got tickets from my good friend Barb Davis over at Canterbury Travel at the time. And I got on the plane the next day, hoping that I'll go up and see the guy in my, you know, and I was way off base. Because anyway, the Columbia Police Department with Crime Stoppers, The police officer, Sam Hargadine, who has now just took a job in Iowa, he calls me up back in Pennsylvania 24 hours later and says, hey, he goes, I think I got your guy. Now I just have to find him. And I'm just going,
unreal.
You got to be kidding me.
Yeah.
And it turned out they found the guy in St. Joseph, Missouri. Of course, he went to a party where he was crap game going on, and he just spent all the money on the crap game.
Oh.
Yeah, yeah, well, whatever. I learned a big lesson.
Yes, yeah, don't leave the nice receipts in the car overnight.
Even if you're going to be, yeah, it's just, you just don't do that kind of stuff.
Before we get into the varsity and downtown, you had a lot of employees through there over the years. I mean, that's part of running a business, especially one like this, where a lot of the people you're going to be working with are going to be students, are going to be some of the townies that are going to be real characters. And in doing some research and flying around online, reading some of the old articles out of the newspaper, there was a terrific column that Forrest Rose wrote talking about the time that he worked there at the Blue Note. You had Forrest in your place, and that must have been an experience.
Forrest Rose, boy. Not only he was a very, very close friend of mine.
Forrest, yeah.
You know, and eventually I would tell people he was my publicist. He was my advisor. He was such a smart guy and a true friend. I met when I first moved to Columbia too. I had known him that long. But I mean, his technique, his you know, even to the point of getting people out of the bar at the end of the night. You know, he came up with this technique at the end of the night where he would take ashtrays and he would just go up and stand right where you were talking, and he'd just pound the ashtrays right in front of you. And he'd be standing,
Mr. Subtle.
He'd just stand there looking at him, and he goes, "You got to leave."
Bang, 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 bang.
And no, there was no way you could stand there. So people would go.
But it's hard to get real angry and get into an argument with somebody pulling a stunt like that.
Oh, no.
I'll tell the listeners right now, go to the website, kbia.org, click on Thinking Out Loud, and I'll put a link up for this column. It's from July of 2000, and it's a riot. I mean, Forrest wrote a lot of things that were a riot, but this is a fun article. You want to go find this. Richard King with us, the owner of the Blue Note. They're celebrating their 25th anniversary this month, and we've been talking a lot about things that went on in an old location over on the business loop. But the big move that you made, I mean, you called it the biggest thing that's happened to you, was coming downtown and getting into the old Varsity Theater. Talk about how that came about.
Well, I mentioned Cullen Klein would be the person involved with that, because, you know, it's funny because I always loved that building. You know, we would walk by it going to the old Blue Note. And I occasionally got in the building to see what it was like, and I'd say, boy, that would be a great place to have a concert. And once again, at Boosh's.
Where everything truly important in town
happens.
Well,
I'd have to say, yeah, we had some power lunches there, believe me. So I'm down at Boosh's, and Cullen Klein is, you know, so Cullen's at the bar, you know, and I, hey, Cullen, how you doing? We, you know, chit-chat, you know. And he just kind of slides up to me. He goes, hey, you know, he goes, you should be in that building, you know. And I just looked at him. I go, I'd love to be in that building.
Yeah, in the Varsity.
I would love to be in that building. And he said, you know what? He goes, let me see what I can do. I happen to be the attorney for the people that own the building. Let me see if I can work something out. And by God, you know, within a year, he had me in that building. And once, like I had said earlier, it was one of the toughest decisions I had to make, but I knew the last thing I said to myself before I hit the pillow was, you got to do it.
You
have to do it.
Oh, yeah. Well, it's like, you know, I'm grown up now and I've got two kids, and you've got to have a real house and you've got to be in a decent neighborhood for the kids to go to school and all this stuff. But there's this crappy little basement apartment I was living in when I met my wife that I still kind of have these fond memories of every now and then. You know, you just think, wow, that was pretty fun. I had a good time there. And the same is true. I was only in once or twice at the old place on the Blue Note. But you've got to have as much time as got put into that place for you. I'm sure there's some reminiscing that goes on from time to time about the old dumpy place.
Unbelievable things happened in that building. It had a huge effect on me.
How old are you?
I'm 51 years old.
51. You're in a business that you do an awful lot of work trying to catch the attention of, trying to figure out what's going to appeal to people that are 23, 25, 27 years old. Is that tough? Are you still having a good time with that and doing it well? Obviously doing it well. The business is thriving. But
I'm having a good time doing it. I think that, you know, I also have, I'm married with two children, and they're relatively young too, 9 and 6 years old, the two boys. Yeah. So, you know, it's a no-brainer for me finding time to hang out with those two, which is great.
Sure. Yeah, you got to do that.
Which is great for me. It's one of the best things that's ever happened to me, is to, you know, to walk away and say, wow, you know, this is this is, you know, a whole different world. But you know, I'll tell you, over the years, and I really, you know, people like to I really don't like the attention focused entirely on me, because it shouldn't be focused on me. There's guys like Forrest Rose that had so much to do with having Kevin Walsh at Streetside Records, mm-hmm. another one. But you know, it's I've said this. I've been really lucky in terms of the people that I surround myself, or the people that surround me, and more so now. You know, I have people that are out there that are just, you know, that's all they do is listen to music, and they'll bring it to me. And I still have great you know, connections with record company people and management people and stuff like that. So they know that we can be trusted. But honestly, it's, you know, the folks that I happen to surround myself with, you know, they keep me up to date on a lot of things. And that's been the case over the years, all the time.
I like to listen when I'm talking to people and grab a word out and build on that. And when I'm reading about the reaction from the musicians, the artists, these guys always have positive stuff to say about Blue Note, about you, about the whole deal there, and trust seems to be a big part of that. Artists know that they're not going to get shafted at the Blue Note, and that's I would assume something that you guys have had to make a conscious decision about. I mean, there's times where it's pretty obvious, you know, we could do this and this and probably get away with it and get an extra $1,000 out of these guys.
Yeah, well, you know, there's nothing that I can think of that would be worse for businesses to have an artist walk out and say, you know, and believe me, it happened to me once or twice, and I was so, you know, taken back by the comment,
that's,
you know,
hard.
But you know, I've always, you know, part of the philosophy is, you know, building relationships, and we built relationships with the actual artist. You know, I mean, we built relationships with the agents, and we built some relationships with the managers. But the artists are the ones that's coming into the building. You know, hey, you know, we need a case of beer. Sure, here's a case of beer. Hey, I know we're not doing well. Can you get us something for dinner? Sure, let's get you some sandwiches for dinner. You know, those kind of things go a long way, you know, when you're building relationships with people. And I mean, the worst kind of publicity you can ever get is to just go ahead and shaft one artist, and when they walk out of the room, believe me.
You'll find out how many friends they have.
That'll get around, you know, faster than you can imagine. But, you know, there are some relationships that were so-so. But, you know, I've always felt strongly about going down there, introducing yourself, and making sure that you have a production manager that can work with people, and just a manager in general in the building that can work with people, and myself going down, and things like that. It's so important to making the experience enjoyable for not only, you know, your staff, but for their crew and stuff like that, but for the, you know, the concert guard. When they show up, they can tell that there's a good kind of vibe going on in the building.
It's kind of sad that unless you really go looking for it, the stories that we who aren't there a lot or around it real closely a lot get to hear about, as far as just with the artists are concerned, tend to be the negative ones. I think probably one of the people are going to be familiar with stuff like the guys from Insane Clown Posse, and there was some legal trouble with that, and was it Kotke that got his guitar ripped off?
Leo had his guitar stolen, who was, you know, those stories are so amazing. You know, take the Insane Clown Posse thing, for example. I mean, they had been in trouble somewhere else. You know, it's not exactly the kind of thing. It goes back to the, hey, you know, it's not exactly my cup of tea, but who am I to say that, you know, that I shouldn't present this. It's like some form of censorship, which I don't believe in that, you know. So anyway, they got in trouble somewhere else. But, you know, I would have to commend I think it was the Boone County Sheriff's Department for waiting till the show was over
to come in.
Or it was the Columbia Police Department, I believe, that handled that one.
Yeah.
They came in and you know, dealt with the artist on you know, an issue that happened. You know, somebody issues a warrant in another state. And sometimes your local police department or sheriff's department will pick up on it. Sometimes they won't. You know, and I've had that happen twice. And I'm like going, hey, you know, you got to answer if somebody's charging with something. And I think both cases, one was an assault, I believe, for the Insane Clown Posse. And the other was the Reverend Horton Heat, who just canceled the show because he thought that the promoter was doing something wrong, and he never showed up to his court date, and they render a judgment. You know,
right,
so they came to Columbia. But those kind of things, you know.
Now, that one's an interesting story. We maybe do a little bit more with that. This is kind of a rockabilly band, and their instruments actually were taken by the sheriff's people, right?
They waited till after the show.
Well, that was thoughtful.
That was thoughtful. I thanked them. I think I could have made life a lot easier for them if they notified me before the show, and I probably could have patched the whole thing up. But what, you know? But that's not their job. I thought they were polite in terms of not coming in and breaking the show up. But they waited till after the show. I remember I was home in bed. I had paid the band, and I wasn't in bed for 5 minutes. And my manager calls. He goes, "You got to come back down." The sheriff is confiscating all of their equipment, and they had a show the next night.
Taking their instruments and everything.
Yeah. And what had happened was they had canceled the show somewhere in North Carolina, and they did not, you know, the promoter had sued them for not, they actually showed up in town that day, but said they were not playing for a certain reason. Well, the promoter had sued them, and they were served papers to show in this court in North Carolina, but they didn't show. So the judge does what they're supposed to do, I imagine, and they just, well, he's not showing, we're going to give the judgment goes in favor of the promoter,
right?
And they issue a warrant for the arrest or whatever, or you know, however that stuff works. And anyway, somehow, 3-6 months later, the warrant lands in Boone County,
and these guys are coming into town, and
the sheriff's department, and they didn't notify me or anything like that. They just waited though till after the show, which I thought, you know, was smart on their part. You know, you don't want a riot on your hands, you know. So they came in. And they explained to them what was going on. They're confiscating all in lieu of payment of this decision that had been made. We're confiscating all of your equipment. So what I had to do was, you know, they were out on the road. I found a local attorney here, a good friend of mine, Bogdan Susan, and I hooked them up with their manager. And they actually got all their equipment back in time for the show the next night, but not after they paid three times what they normally would have paid if they had answered the charges in North Carolina originally. So. You know, that's kind of a wake-up call.
You told them when a man in a black dress tells you be here at this time, you show up.
You know, even I know that.
Yes.
Even I abide by those rules. I'll say this another thing, though. I mean, the opportunity that, you know, and I this may sound corny, but the fact that I can do what I'm doing in a town like Columbia, Missouri, you know, I'm sure there's quite a few people that would probably like to be in my position. And the more I think about the things that have happened to me, it's just, you know, I've been a really lucky person. You know, I've been really lucky in a lot of ways, you know, and I always think when, you know, I'm having that bad day, I'm like, get over it, Richard. Come on. You know, it ain't so bad, you know, just pick up and move on here.
Doing what you want to do and enjoy doing, and you're in a good place. And
it's you
and me both there, brother.
Yeah. You know exactly what I'm talking
right
about.
Right on.
There,
oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Well, that was a fun conversation, and we are listening to a visit we had with Richard King from all the way back in 2005, a best of Thinking Out Loud this evening here on KBIA. We're back with a new show next week and a new feature on our program. If you are interested in planting and gardening, you should definitely listen in. Trevor Harris is going to have something really special for you starting on next Tuesday evening show. Remember, you can follow Thinking Out Loud on Facebook, or on Twitter. It's KBIA Thinking, and we'll get you updated on everything that's happening with the show. As I mentioned in our open, some really, really special stuff coming up in the weeks and months ahead. So be sure to listen in every Tuesday evening for Thinking Out Loud here on KBIA. Till then, for Associate Producer Trevor Harris, I'm Darren Hellwedge. Have a great evening.